Today on the 21st, what is it like to be a game show contestant?
They have these, like, hype men, these people who come out and just, like, tell you to clap and clap. You know, they'll stop taping and be like, you know, we need you guys to look more excited. Everyone is excited, but it feels really weird and phony. And by the end of it, like, everyone is exhausted.
We talk with Illinois residents who have been on The Price is Right and Jeopardy and get their tips for game show success. Plus, we'll talk summer gardening with experts from across the state. But first, one of the biggest questions high school students face is, how am I going to pay for college? Yet in Illinois, sometimes winning a scholarship means your financial aid will take a hit.
They're being rewarded academically with scholarships from outside organizations, and then it seems as if their particular institutions are punishing them for all that hard work.
That's coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. When a high school senior gets awarded a college scholarship, it should be a time to celebrate. More money for college means fewer loans and less crushing debt upon graduation. So you can imagine the disappointment when a student finds out that because they've been awarded an external scholarship, their financial aid package is going to be cut. That's what happened to Jalissa Garcia. She's now a senior at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where she's studying bioengineering. And she joins us now. Jalissa, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So you've received several scholarships to attend college. So let's just start off with a brief overview of the scholarships that you received and a little bit more information about those.
So I received two scholarships for 4 years. The first one is, of course, George M. Pullman Scholarship. And then I also received the Colonel Henry Crown Scholarship as well. And those are both for four years of university.
Well, first of all, congratulations. That's really awesome. And let's go back to when you found that news. I'm sure you were over the moon and really excited. And then you went to notify the colleges that you had been accepted to. And as I am to understand, as you shared this news of these awesome scholarships that you've worked really hard for and you received, you got some not so great news in return from them. So could you talk about what they told you when you notified them?
Yes. So, you know, I was really happy about receiving these scholarships, and every single year you have to, you know, on my award letter, I was able to notify my university that I did receive these scholarships. And once I received back from, received a letter back from them stating that, you know, my aid had been reduced, and I was kind of, you know, disappointed and sort of confused as to why they would reduce my math grant. And so I, you know, took it upon myself to call the office, and they told me that because I'd received two scholarships, I was in. They had to reduce my MAP grant, so due to tuition issues, or they just said that they had to reduce my aid, and so it was very kind of, it was kind of disappointing, because it felt like, you know, I had worked so hard for these two scholarships, and I was promised, you know, my MAP grant. And you know, when I found out about that, I just felt like, you know, I had to figure out how to get money for books and for my transportation elsewhere, because I had to compensate for the money that was taken away.
So I assume that as you're hearing this news, this was a complete shock to you. This was not something anyone had prepared you for. So what were some of the initial first thoughts and feelings that you had as you're trying to figure out what this next 4 years is going to look like financially?
You know, I was upset, and I, you know, it was kind of like thinking about this backup plan, like, okay, if I can't afford certain things for school, how I was going to be able to financially support and be able to financially get that money. And luckily, I was able to get internships over the summer for these 4 years, and it has worked out. But at that moment, when I first found out, it was kind of a shocker, and I had to really, like, think about, okay, how much would, you know, all these other costs cost me, and how would I be able to have this backup plan to be able to actually maintain myself and be able to pay everything that I needed for college.
Well, and it sounds like it was a lot of extra added stress that you hadn't anticipated, which is something, you know, no one wants to have to face when they think they have it all figured out, and then someone, you know, takes the rug out, so to speak, out from underneath them. So I'm actually really curious if it affected at all your decision on where you would go to college, because I, if I'm understanding correctly, you got accepted to multiple colleges. And then did you ever feel like you had to choose between accepting the scholarship or accepting accepting the financial aid?
So when I was looking for different universities, once I got their financial aid award letters, it was a really tough decision for me, just because my main goals in finding a university was if it was financially affordable, if they had the program I was looking for, and also if they had programs that supported minorities and first-generation students. And so those were my big three targets. And so when I was looking for schools, you know, knowing that my aid would be reduced kind of did play into the fact of what university I chose. I was looking into one university that I had called multiple times, and they had told me that there was just no possible way that they would help me further with my financial aid. And it really discouraged me from going there because I felt like I was being turned away. And so at UIC, my university I currently go to, they were really welcoming in the sense that, you know, I felt like at least I would be financially comfortable here. And they also had the program I wanted. You know, everything clicked into place with that university. And so I felt like that was the best decision for me. There was one school in particular that did have a really big scholarship from their institution that they were going to give to me because I qualified for it. And I felt at that moment like I did have to choose maybe between accepting my scholarship, a scholarship, and accepting that other scholarship, particularly from that university. And I felt like I was in this, you know, like rut, like, do I accept which scholarship do I accept? And it kind of felt like I was put in this tough place where I didn't want to have to choose, you know, what kind of aid I received. And so it really did change kind of where I went and my thoughts on the school afterwards. And what was really best for me was, you know, accepting my scholarship. I felt like, you know, I applied, I went through this whole process, and, you know, to not accept it, I just felt like it just wouldn't be right. And so that really did influence my decision.
Well, Julissa, I want to thank you so much for not only joining us today, but sharing your story and your experience.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So I'd like to go now to Robin Redmond. She's the executive director for the George M. Pullman Educational Foundation, which provides scholarships to students like Julissa and to other Chicago area students. Robin, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Liz, for having us. We're happy to be talking about this particular issue.
Yes, I had no idea that some students had to make these choices, and that's just something you never want to see a student have to choose between. So the Pullman Foundation awards scholarships of up to $10,000 per year for outstanding high school seniors who demonstrate a financial need. So we just heard Julissa's story. I imagine there are plenty of others who have found themselves in a similar position, correct?
Absolutely. Interestingly enough, the foundation awarded its first class of scholarships in 1950. We have documentation here in the foundation's office where the executive director back in 1983 was writing about this exact same problem that still exists today. Young people are working very hard to make sure that they can pay for school. They're being rewarded academically with scholarships from outside organizations, and then it seems as if their particular institutions are punishing them for all that hard work and perseverance.
Yeah, I think so punishment is a good term to use there, right? Okay. And it just doesn't seem fair. So there was actually one particular student you wrote about in your column for the Chicago Sun-Times who was awarded a Pullman Foundation scholarship to study electrical engineering at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. So can you give us an idea of his story and what happened with him?
Well, you know, it's a similar situation. He's a student. In fact, we're in the process of renewing scholarships right now, so we're looking at applications and all of their financial aid information. He's a student that had strong financial need. He decided to go to the University of Illinois. He had won a particular scholarship specific to his major, and when he notified the financial aid office of his outside scholarship awards, they reduced that particular amount of aid. As I looked at his information yesterday, he still has a significant gap in terms of what he and his family are able to afford related to his tuition and his cost of attendance and the difference between those particular those things. So I believe it was almost $14,000 that they were still suggesting that his family either support through a Parent PLUS loan or a federal Stafford loan, whether secured or unsecured Stafford loan, which is typically what we see.
So I think we can all kind of assume what this means for a lot of students when they receive a scholarship. They're excited about that, and then they find out their financial aid is going to get cut. But can you give us a sense of the next steps for a lot of these students and the decisions they have to make and where they go from there?
Sure. I mean, I can tell you what that looks like from the perspective of the foundation. One of the things that we do as an organization is to try and help the student negotiate that particular roadmap, whether it be having discussions with a contact within the financial aid office, trying to help the student figure out if perhaps there are other scholarship awards, if we can, I hate to describe it this way, but start stacking scholarship awards so that we can find things that help meet that total cost of attendance, even if institutional aid ends up being reduced. So there's a lot of different things. Some universities that we work with, because our scholars both attend public and private universities, will work with us to make concessions. So, for instance, if we know that they'll allow us to apply their scholarship dollars towards paying their health insurance, or they may work very hard, they'll sort of finagle it so that there's a reduction in a specific area that doesn't affect their institutional aid. If it has to be, it's quite tricky, and I'm going to try and explain it as best as I can. When you think about financial aid and the cost to attend college, there are tuition costs, and then there are the other incidental costs, room
right.
and board if a young person is living on campus, books, general fees and expenses, and then if, you know, you, God forbid, want to order a pizza one night
right.
with your friends,
it's,
that you have some
it's
money
not
in
just
your pocket.
Summed up into
exactly.
one number, right? Like, you can't
exactly.
be like, well, you can go to college and experience everything for this price. And it
exactly.
varies for each student. And as we've been talking about, it's got to be extremely disappointing and defeating to get this news that maybe they thought their college costs would be covered, and then they end up having to take out loans after all. So what's the rationale from the university's perspective on doing this?
You know, it's interesting. There have been a number of different since the organization and the state of Maryland passed their particular legislation. There's a variety of different discussions going on right now. Some people are saying that the reason that the institutional aid is decreased when a student wins an outside scholarship is about spreading the money around the pot a little bit more evenly, right? That there are young people who don't have any support, and so if someone's getting an outside scholarship, we should take that money that we've, our institutional grant that we've made to them, or our institutional aid, and we should give that to somebody else so that all of our scholars are benefiting. There's also the argument that students are overfunded. So if somebody's able to get their complete cost of attendance taken care of, they're considered to be overfunded. Instead of looking at it from the perspective of here's a young person that's going to be able to graduate college and not have any debt. A lot of colleges feel as if a young person has to have some type of skin in the game, and so that's why they're making, at least this is my perception of, that's why they're making those particular choices that they're making when it comes to how they distribute their institutional aid.
Well, and I mentioned just moments ago, you recently wrote a column about this for the Chicago Sun-Times, and we'll tweet that out for everyone who's listening at 21ST Show. But what kind of policy changes would you like to see take place in Illinois to help with reducing the burden of debt on college students after they graduate?
Sure. You know, I would love it if the students who are really working hard and proving themselves academically, if we can just help them out by making sure that they are graduating college with little to no debt, because they can really move out into the workforce and they can contribute almost immediately without having to be concerned about their student loans and what those particular monthly payments look like. We know from research that affects so much of their decision-making about whether they take a certain job or how they move forward with thinking about savings or buying a home. So it's important from that perspective. I also just think it's incredibly important because these students, at least the ones that we're working with at the Pullman Foundation, are the best of the best. They have made sacrifices throughout their high school career. So many of our scholars are honors students. They're taking AP courses, and have it, their GPAs are way above our minimum of 3.0. Most of them are 4.0 students. Some of them have part-time jobs when they're in high school. They're participating in extracurriculars. So they're really proving themselves. And I feel as though they should be honored and they should be recognized for that hard work. And if what that looks like is financial support so that they can continue to be great contributors to society, then that's what should unfold.
Right. And let's take it back just a step, Robin, if you don't mind. You mentioned in passing Maryland and some things, you know, they're taking action in this effort. They've actually banned public universities from, quote, clawing back money that has been awarded.
Yeah, that's their term.
So any efforts towards doing that same thing in other states, including Illinois? Are you seeing a trend towards that? Are they setting a path?
I think it's very early for that discussion in Illinois, obviously. We're very happy that that our state legislators recently passed a budget. So we know for a fact that those discussions are...
That's step one.
It's a little premature here. But I will say that there is a group of us. There's actually an organization that is a National Scholarship Providers Association organization. And so there are a number of other foundations scholarship foundations that are looking at this issue. And Maryland really has now turned into our North Star for what we might be able to do in our own particular geographic locations.
Robin Redman is the executive director for the George M. Pullman Educational Foundation, which provides scholarships to Chicago area students. Robin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. It's summertime, and for gardeners, that means getting outside, taking care of your flowers, your vegetables and fruits, and even making plans for what you'll be planting in your fall garden. We've got two experts with us now to provide tips and advice for all things gardening, whether you're experienced or new to the game, or maybe you're even just a little bit curious about getting started. I'm joined now on the line from Collinsville, just east of St. Louis, by Elizabeth Wally, a University of Illinois Extension educator. Elizabeth, welcome back to The 21st.
Thanks. Welcome.
And joining me here in the studio in Urbana, Diane Nolan. She's the host of WILL-TV's Mid-American Gardener, now in its 25th season. Diane, thanks for being with us as well.
Glad to be here and to be with Elizabeth.
Yes, your former TA, which
yes,
I love to hear.
It's great.
I also should point out that Mid-American Gardener is hosting a really awesome event tomorrow for the folks of the Champaign-Urbana greater area. It's the Mid-American Gardener Roadshow at Urbana's Market at the Square. So local gardening experts from the show will be on hand from 9 to 11 tomorrow morning. And they're encouraging you to bring out not only your questions, but perhaps a branch, a plant, a flower, some photos, whatever you want to show them and talk about, they're going to be out there for you. But we're going to be doing a bit of that right now here on the 21st. So I'm super excited. I have to say, both to Diane and Elizabeth, I am not a gardener myself, so I hope to be learning a few things with you here today. But Diane, let's start with you. What are some of the most important things for gardeners to be thinking about at this point in the season? Like, what are you hearing from people right now?
Well, actually, it's weeding and probably mulching because of the heat. And so that's what I've been doing for the last week or so, is just weeding, trying to get things back in control, and then mulching, because supplemental water will hold better once you have mulch laid down. And we strive for an inch a week. And, you know, it's been so spotty for everybody this summer. So after you water, that mulch will hold it in. So those are the things I've been working on, plus pruning because of having windstorms. So removing some limbs that aren't where they should be and aren't connected anymore.
So what about with flowers and ornamental trees and shrubs and things? Are there things you have to do with those right now, or is that also just really focusing on weeding, cleaning up, mulching, that sort of stuff?
When it's hot like this, you mainly just maintain. You don't really want to fertilize right now. Usually it's a little bit later in the year for trees and shrubs. And a lot of times you already put it on your flowers.
Okay.
But usually it's maintaining that moisture level.
Okay.
Now for tomatoes and things like that, you do want to check for spotted leaves and removing any leaves that might have some issues and just taking them off the site. And then also mulching. Have I said mulching enough?
Is it time to mulch right now?
I think so.
So Elizabeth, tomatoes makes me think your expertise is with fruits and vegetables. So what are some common questions that people have about gardening with those at this time of year?
Well, kind of going off what Diane said right now, when we're in a period of, you know, really hot, long periods of dry, is that you really need to be on top of your watering, too. So on top of, you know, the mulch that Diane mentioned, did we say mulch enough to help conserve the water, you also need to be adding more water. So when we have crops like tomatoes and several other things that are in your vegetable garden, you want to really maintain that uniform moisture. One of the things we run into with this really hot, dry weather, you know, beyond keeping your eye out for diseases, for tomatoes, for example, we can get blossom end rot, which results from a calcium deficiency, and it really comes from having those really uneven, wet, dry cycles in the soil. So this is the time of the year to, you know, really kind of poke your finger in the soil. If you can feel it moisture kind of like a well-wrung sponge, then you're doing okay. If you stick your finger in and it feels pretty dry, top it up with a little bit of water and try to really maintain a uniform moisture level.
And sticking with the watering, because again, I could kill just about any plant, it is true that overwatering is worse than underwatering, correct?
Yeah, you can definitely, and this goes well beyond, you know, just vegetables, which I work with, but anytime you have a container plant that is not self-draining, you can really get them too wet, too. So if you take up all the airspace and the plant just effectively suffocates, if you want to look at it that way. So, yeah, what you're really looking for is watering to maintain that, you know, just uniform moisture. And as I mentioned before, what we're shooting for is to feel like taking a sponge, filling it with water and squeezing it out, and you know what that feels like. And that's kind of what you're shooting for with soil moisture levels.
So, Diane, I've been noticing several recent headlines about Japanese beetles and their high numbers across Illinois. Is there a particular area of the state that's been hit harder than others?
It is spotty. Now, I know in the Champaign-Urbana area and my rural area, it is really, it's horrendous. How is it for you, Elizabeth, in your neck of the woods?
On the plants that they prefer to eat, they can be very bad. You start out in the morning when it's still cool and they haven't made their presence known, but as the day heats up and they, you know, really like sunlight, man, they are just flying and eating away on plants they love.
Well, and Diane, they're called, are they called hot spots that they like to kind of nest and burrow in, correct? Can you talk a little bit about what those are and how to avoid them?
Well, the hot spots tend to be a lot of the trees that they're actually eating on. Can I mention some things they really like?
Oh, of course, please.
Linden trees. Now, I planted this beautiful linden well before Japanese beetles, and they have it pretty much lacy skeletonized. It's brown. It won't kill it, but I think the poor thing would wish that maybe it's moved past, but they like grapes, a lot of different weeds, smart weeds. They love roses. I know some nurserymen that actually take the rose flowers off during the Japanese beetle time of the year and then them come back. Those are things they really do like. As others, they like zinnias and other things as well. Beans, oh no, they like green beans and soybeans.
Oh wow, so they have an eclectic taste
across the board.
Elizabeth, is there anything that people can be doing to protect, especially their fruits and vegetables, if they are growing those to either sell them or eat them? They want to protect them beyond just the beauty of the plant itself. Is there something people can be doing?
Well, one thing, and this is really kind of a piece of advice for next year, it's really important to early in the season keep your eyes open for those early invaders that come in, because they kind of work as a community. And if I humanize them a little bit, it's kind of like someone finds some good food and they tell all their buddies. And that's what leads to the hot spots that Diane was talking about. So one of the goals that we have is, you know, really kind of walking your garden daily and really looking at it again in the full sun when they're really out and saying, oh, there's the first one, I'm going to take care of it. Now, if you're organic, if you can get on top of those very first ones, you can just walk along with a soapy bucket of water and knock them down in it. The soap breaks the surface tension in the water, and so when they fall in, they go to the bottom and drown that way. That's one of the easiest ways, but when we're now, if you haven't done anything and they're just large amounts, there are organic insecticides that can be used if you want to kill them. You can use spray jets of water to knock them off, but that just knocks them off. They will come back on that. But there are also then conventional insecticides. And this is one of those things that if you really don't want to spray a whole lot, keep in mind that they usually feed in the top part of the plant. And so that's the critical place to do some control, not necessarily having to spray the entire plant.
Seems like they're real, they like to sunbathe. It would seem that they like to be out in the open and that they're pretty easy to spot. So that's good. Diane, I understand that the most common question that you've been getting recently on Mid-American Gardener is, why are there black areas on the bottom of my tomatoes? So what's going on there? Is that what you were mentioning earlier?
In fact, when Elizabeth said that about blossom end rot, I thought, Eureka, that is our most often asked question. It's, again, the uneven watering, you know, the calcium deficiency. I want to give a few tips, and I guess it's going to be for next year, so we're really doing the next year thing. But when I plant my tomatoes, I immediately cover them either with a few layers of newspaper or cardboard, and then I mulch immediately. I'm trying to not have that soil leaf contact, but then the mulch helps with moisture. But I actually supplemental water my tomatoes. Everything else is somewhat on its own in the vegetable garden, but I've got some new interesting heirlooms this year that I want to have them do well. So I have no blossom end rot, but I do remove those lower kind of spotted leaves. And you'll notice the tomato growers do that, and I can see them in the greenhouses, and they have the lower leaves removed. Elizabeth, what else are they trying to keep down by removing, you know, the leaf spot on the tomatoes?
Well, I think you're just right on target with that. The main reason, as you know, is when a raindrop hits the soil, if there's any overwintering pathogen that's survived on soil leaf matter, it can splash back up on the leaves. So the idea is remove, you know, lower leaves so there's, you know, a higher distance to have to travel to infect a leaf. So that's something homeowners can do in combination with, we talk about using mulch, your newspaper and the mulch, but another purpose of not only cooling the soil and providing moisture, but it also prevents that raindrop from making the contact with the soil and splashing pathogens. So that adds to pretty good disease control, too. And as you say, Diane, if you just happen to get some spotting, remove those leaves immediately, because raindrops hitting a spotted leaf then can splash it up to the next leaf higher. So it's kind of a good system to be having good sanitation out in your garden.
And then another thing to add to this is that I definitely do crop rotation in my vegetable garden. So I move them in. I have raised wide row beds, so I just move them around, and that helps to keep down anything that might be in the soil.
So you're talking from season to season,
from
correct?
From season to season, that's correct. So I know where I'm going to plant tomatoes because it's just, actually, I think it's clockwise in my garden, so I just know to move it farther down the rows and not have tomatoes in the same spot. A lot of gardeners do that, tomatoes over and over in the same spot.
And it's better to move them around, is
absolutely,
what you're saying.
Absolutely, because you'll have that inoculant, you'll have that disease.
Well, and I think that's something that a lot of people, say myself, that lack the green thumb, don't really think about how much planning that you may put into seasons ahead of time. So if we're looking, or so we're now, we're, you know, in peak summer, peak heat, but a lot of people are actually thinking about the fall and they're thinking about next year, correct? So Elizabeth, what are people doing as far as their fall gardening thoughts and plannings right now, and what can they be doing to make sure it's going to be a good fall season for them?
Well, I know I'm a vegetable gardener, too, just like Diane, and I can relate to some of the things I'm doing right now. For example, I've already harvested off one of my beds of garlic, and so that is a fall-planted crop. So I'm already thinking about preparing an area for where I'm going to plant in October and November. But as Diane says, there's rotation, so I have this nice empty space right now in the garden where the garlic was. And so I'm already thinking about, you know, what can I plant there? What do I have time before frost comes to plant? And, you know, there are a number of things. I still have time to grow some more green onions, maybe some more kohlrabi or collards or some turnips, maybe even some bush beans, some of the shorter seasoned ones. And so, you know, as you're harvesting off your spring planted or late spring planted things, you can be thinking about planting things that really like cooler weather. It's really hot right now, but this is the time to be starting planting of your fall garden as well as your cleaning out beds.
So for the listeners out there who are perhaps curious but not brave enough yet to start their own garden, what would you suggest, Diane, being their first step if they wanted to start down the gardening path, so to speak?
Well, if you're really a novice, you might start with plants. You know, you might start with something, you know, I know people even do lettuce plants. They'll put them in and you have an immediate impact. However, lettuce and spinach in the spring are some of the easiest things to grow from seed. And so I do probably, except for broccoli and cauliflower and tomatoes, I do everything else from seed. And I have friends who do 50 varieties of tomatoes from a seed, but I don't want to get that involved with it. But they might start with plants. That's pretty easy. However, there are a lot of plants that are super easy. As I mentioned, lettuce and spinach. Turnips really turn around quite quickly. You may say, oh, I hate turnips. What about peas? Peas are great because it's a big seed and it's easy to plant. Now, I always soak my pea seed the night before I plant them to get them to take up moisture. And then, you know, plant something you're going to actually eat. And so I do sugar snap peas and eat them right off the vines. And
sounds delicious.
I know some people who hide their pea plantings.
Oh, so I can imagine.
So they don't get them eaten by their kids. So
or by me.
But that's the secret, is to plant things you really, if you don't like turnips, don't plant them. Now, our family likes beets, and those are super easy to start and to grow. Corn.
Okay.
Now, I live in an area where I get too many critters, but corn, those are big seeds, and they're easy to plant. I think another novice issue is people plant their seeds too close or do not thin them. One other little hint, as I do a little divot in the row, I plant my seeds so I can tell how far apart. I kind of tuck them in with the side of my hand, you know, so seed-soil contact, and then I put a little bit of potting soil over it. You know, depending on if the seed needs to be a quarter an inch or a half inch planted, you know, a little bit of soil, but a little bit of potting mixture so I know where the row is and it drains well, it doesn't crust. And now my son is an expert planter. He's just done a few of my tips. And
passing it along.
And I learned it from my grandpa.
Well, that's nice. Keeping it in the family. I love to hear that. And actually, that parlays nicely into, sadly, our last question because we are running out of time here. But I'm curious, Diane, as you've hosted Mid-American Gardener for the past 25 years, there has to have been an evolution of some sort. Maybe not so much with the gardening itself. I imagine that mostly stays the same. But have you seen an evolution in your viewers, in your listeners, the people that interact with you, the people who garden?
It's interesting. We definitely have an older demographic who watches it, but I find people of all ages come up to me in the grocery store and say, oh, I have a question. Is that okay? So I have noticed more students. That's probably the biggest evolution. But I've seen people in other areas, you know, physics and chemistry and accounting. They actually are interested in fresh and locally grown. So I think it's growing it and then seeing it on the table. I had a fourth grader who asked me a question. I said, do you garden? He said, no, but I think the show is so interesting. A fourth
awesome.
Grader. I couldn't believe that. So
that's awesome. And there is got to be some special pride there. Growing something from your own hands and then serving it at your table has got to be such an amazing feeling.
It tastes better. I had beets, golden beets, and I grew albino beet. And Chioggia is my favorite. And I had that last night for supper. It was so good because you grew it yourself. You know where it comes from.
Well, thank you so much. I apologize that we have run out of time. We've been talking about gardening do's and don'ts, advice, tips, and tricks with Diane Nolan and Elizabeth Wally. Thanks so much for joining us on the 21st.
Thanks.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo today. Ever wonder what it's like to be on a game show? Today I'm joined by two people from Illinois who've been contestants before, and they're here with us now to share their experiences. In our studio in Urbana, I'm joined by Pranjal Vachaspati, who is a graduate student in computer science at the University of Illinois and was a contestant on Jeopardy. Pranjal, welcome to The 21st. I appreciate you joining us today.
Hey, it's great to be here.
And joining us on the line from New Lenox in the southwest suburbs of Chicago is former Price is Right contestant Kyle Hall. Kyle, also welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Kyle, I'm actually going to start with you. I got to say that I imagined this once as a kid or many times as a kid. Can you take us back to the moment where they said, Kyle Hall, come on down. You're the next contestant on the Price is Right.
Well, there's actually like a little bit of a delay in the episode from when they call my name to when I realize that I'm called, because the way that it's mixed in the studio, you can't really hear like when they call your name down. I just saw some other people like in my row who were pointing at me, and then I realized that I was being called down. So I didn't realize it right away, but I just started jumping up and down.
I will say, Kyle, I did a little research on YouTube and I saw how excited you were. And I think the kid in all of us were excited for you. I think I would have that same reaction of like, wait, me? Like me? This is happening? Can you pull back the curtain a little bit and tell us the backstory behind how you even got onto the show and how you get called down? I don't know what the procedure there is.
Okay, so I have been traveling around the country playing in various bands, and whenever we are going to, you know, L.A. or when we were in Atlanta, we were on a taping for The Family Feud. We just kind of look up what game shows are filming, and most of them are free to be in the audience. I've heard a rumor that Family Feud even pays you to be in the audience. So when we were in L.A., we decided to go to the taping of The Price is Right, and they screen you out while you're waiting in line to get into the studio. So they have like little interviews where they ask you questions, and basically just the most excited people, or like if you have like a sob story and you start crying, or if like you're a grandma and you say that you've been watching the show for like 40 years, they already know. You don't know when the taping starts, but they already know who they're calling down.
So Kyle, quickly, did you have a hook, a catch that you were pitching out there to these people that were interviewing? Like what got you think chosen?
I didn't really have a hook. I was telling them that I was in a rock and roll band, but mostly I was just jumping up and down and dancing. They really like it when you dance.
Good to know. Pranjal, I'd like to turn it over to you because I assume your game show experience was a little bit different being on Jeopardy last summer. And you won over $137,000 over the course of 7 episodes. So first of all, congratulations. That's awesome. But what was your experience like?
So I took the online Jeopardy test, which they offer, I think, once or twice a year. And I took it just kind of on a whim because one of my friends had been on the show. And, you know, I took it and it's like 50 questions and you have 15 minutes to answer them. And if you get a certain amount right, then they invite you for an interview. So I flew out to, or not an interview, an audition. So I flew out to San Francisco for the audition. And, you know, I was, the point at the audition, they ask you some questions, but the point is just to find out who's enthusiastic. Kind of like Kyle said, you know, who's excited to be on the show, who's going to speak loudly. because, you know, they do have problems with Jeopardy contestants not speaking loudly.
So on speaking of, like, getting excited and really nerve-wracking situations, there's one episode that you eked out a victory over your closest opponent, and I think it was, like, $300.
Yeah.
That's a really close margin, especially when you're talking about Jeopardy. So can you take us back to that moment? What was going through your head?
I mean, it was pretty nerve-wracking. I just figured, you know, I've done pretty good, and and if I can win this one, that'll also be good. So I just, you know, did as best as I could for the...
Were you nervous at the time, or did you just kind of really hone in and focus on what you were doing?
You know, I don't get nervous easily. I was a little nervous, but mostly I was just focused on, you know, doing as best as I could.
So could you talk to us about how you prepared to be on the show? Because I've heard that you had a very interesting way of getting yourself ready.
Yeah. So I had about a month before I knew, like, from when I knew I was going to be on the show to when I taped. So there's this big online archive of Jeopardy questions from basically every show. So there's like thousands of them. And there's a, I wrote a computer program that would basically run through Jeopardy games so I could practice kind of things like buzzer timing and also figure out what my weak points were so I could shore up on those. So I figured out my weak points, and the questions they asked a lot about were things like Shakespeare and the Kings of England and stuff. So I was able to focus on those. And then, you know, of course, when I was on the show, there were whole categories about those things. So.
So, Kyle, in comparison, did you do any preparing in advance of getting on The Price is Right, maybe do a little extra grocery shopping, keeping track of prices, things of that nature?
It's funny, like, when I found out that I was going to be on the show, I automatically, you know, started telling everyone, I'm going to get called down. Like, I'm going to get called down. And my friends and family would tell me, you know, you're jinxing it. Don't say stuff like that. But I was working as a cashier. And so I would actually just, I would always joke with my customers that I was training to be on The Price is Right by trying to guess the amount of money that their groceries were before I rung it up.
I can't even think of a better way to train.
I watch the show a lot.
Yeah. I can't think of a better way to train for The Price is Right than working right there as a cashier. That's awesome. So obviously you're a big fan of game shows, Kyle. So what were your expectations versus the real world situation of being on The Price is Right?
I honestly had no idea what to expect going into it. I guess the studio is always smaller than it looks like it is on TV. Yeah. I was surprised how many times they kind of had to stop and start the show, like, while they were taping, because, you know, one brand of something didn't look exactly right, or Drew Carey said something that was one word off from what it was supposed to be. So they had to stop in the middle of the taping and, like, retape things. And I guess one thing that was always different from my expectation on all of the game shows that I've been in the audience of is they have these, like, hype men, these people who come out and just, like, tell you to clap and clap and clap and to be excited. And, you know, they'll stop taping and be like, you know, we need you guys to look more excited. And it kind of feels, everyone is excited, but it feels really weird and phony. And by the end of it, like, everyone is exhausted.
I can imagine. And I heard that you got to meet Drew Carey. Is that correct?
Yeah. So during the commercial breaks of game shows, like, each of the hosts go around and do different things. So, like, Steve Harvey will do stand up on Family Feud. And during Let's Make a Deal, they'll play music and have people dance and just give away money like crazy. But during The Price is Right, Drew Carey will go around and just sort of talk to people in the audience and sort of interview them. I guess people who seem, like I said, the most excited, and we were going nuts.
And so, Pranjal, to you, did you get to hang out with Alex Trebek? I mean, 7 episodes, that's got to take a while, right?
Yeah, so actually, they have super strict rules on Jeopardy because, well, in the 1950s, there were these game show scandals where they were all rigged. There's a movie, Quiz Show, that's a documentary about this.
Okay.
But now they have all these rules and lawyers that basically say that the people who interact with the contestants have to basically be firewalled from the people who know what the questions are. So basically the only interaction that we had with Alex was kind of what you see on TV.
Really? Yeah. Okay. I mean, it totally makes sense having that context that it used to be rigged and they need to be careful of that. And can you share any experiences that you had while on Jeopardy that people just watching wouldn't know take place behind the scenes or anything like that?
Yeah. So one of the cool things is it happens like it's a 30-minute show and it's taped in exactly 30 minutes. The commercial breaks are like Alex takes questions from the audience during those. So they're, you know, incredibly good at what they do. They've done like 7,500 Jeopardy shows and they know how to do Jeopardy.
So it is a well-tuned or fine-oiled machine, as they say, or whatever?
Yeah, they shoot 5 episodes a day. So they know what they're doing.
That has to be pretty tiring. So did you do 5 episodes in a row?
I did 4 episodes one day and 3 episodes the other day.
Oh, and speaking of the legal ramifications are possible, Kyle, I am to understand that after the show, right after, you had to sign all kinds of paperwork. Can you talk about that? And if you're able and capable, can you talk about some of the things you had to agree to?
Well, right. Yeah, I don't know how much of it is sort of hush-hush, but that was another thing that was definitely different from my expectation. Like, it is freaky how good they are at doing this, right? Like, shooting multiple episodes in a day, and, like, everyone is so excited, and it's almost like you're in shock, like you're in some kind of dream world as it's going because everyone is so excited. But then the moment that the cameras stop rolling, they flip all the lights off and they take all the contestants, and I lost. I didn't win the product that I was bidding on, but I still had to, they like shuffle you into a white room with all these lawyers. They make you sign all sorts of agreements. And one of the agreements that I signed was that I couldn't be a contestant on another like CBS game show for a certain number of years. I couldn't tell anyone that I was a contestant on The Price is Right. I couldn't talk about it on social media. So I don't use social media, but they took everyone's social media accounts and I guess they follow you and everything to make sure you're not telling anyone.
That seems very intense. Pranjal, did you find the same kind of paperwork and...
Yeah, I mean, since we know we're going to be on the show before we get there, they mail it to us ahead of time.
Okay.
But yeah, there is this, you know, list of things that I agreed to that I have no idea what I agreed to. But
so far, no one's come after you.
Yeah, yeah.
So you guys are both doing pretty good. So Pranjal, we'll stick with you for just a second. You're going to be invited back this fall to be on a Tournament of Champions. So
yeah.
How are you preparing this time?
I'm basically using the same tactics. I'm focusing on kind of the Tournament of Champions type questions, which tend to be a little more academic, a little harder, less pop culture-y kind of. I'm studying, I'm practicing, I'm preparing.
So since you said it's such a well-oiled machine, you prepare and then you just go out there and shoot it and you're done? There's no extra extraneous before or after type stuff?
So usually in the morning they let you practice on the buzzers. You know, there's some amount of waiting just because we get there early in the morning and then they start shooting it around 10 or 11 usually. So there's some practice time, some, you know, making sure everyone has their forms filled out right. You have to, you know how Alex Trebek kind of has a little banter with each of the contestants. So preparing for that, you put like 3 things on a note card about yourself and he picks one on the show.
All right then.
Yeah.
So they prepare in many different ways.
Yeah.
Kyle, I know that you mentioned just a couple moments ago that you've been in the audience for a few game shows, I think Family Feud and Let's Make a Deal. So can you talk about like maybe how those are different or if you've had a favorite game show experience outside of The Price is Right?
They were all actually really similar. And it's funny how different it is from a game show like Jeopardy where the contestants are picked beforehand and sort of given this opportunity to prepare and everything, because the whole time the show is taping there, it's like the carrot on a stick, you know, like you could get called at any time and they're constantly reminding you of that. And I was actually the last person to get called up on The Price is Right. So it's just like on all 3 of those shows, well, I guess on Family Feud, right, you have your family and you have to audition, but Steve Harvey does all sorts of stuff in the commercial breaks. I'm always surprised at like how small and pristine It's just really freaky. It's sort of like being in a science fiction movie.
So, Kyle, it's, from what I understand, been on your bucket list for a long time to be on these shows. So what's next in your game show career? Where are you going to down the road?
Well, I'm hoping that I don't have to wait until I get married to get on Family Feud. Like, I don't want to have to marry into a family, you know, that wants to be a contestant. So I've been kind of digging deep in the family, cousins, second cousins, things like that, trying to assemble some sort of team who would be willing to audition, because I think I'd be really good at that show. But there is that new game show. I think it's called The Wall, and it's just like giant Plinko from The Price is Right. Like, the entire game is Plinko, and they just drop a ball down like a, you know, like a huge board, and you just win tons of money. So
that is,
I think I'd like to be on that show.
Yeah, that is a Price is Right favorite for sure. Well, Pranjal, best of luck in the fall to you, and Kyle, best of luck on going through the family tree to find your Family Feud team. I want to thank both of you for joining us for our game show chat today here on the 21st.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. I'm Liz Westfield, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.